some new features to it that I have really found I utilized when I was working on our lectures as far as the evidence-based practice. They have the Help People 2030 in there. I like the teaching guidelines, the drug guidelines. The little take note feature draws your attention to the points of critical emphasis throughout the chapter. So there's some really good things. And then at the end of the chapter, there is a concept mastery that I want you all to be sure and review. So as we go through, I will address some of those things. So now let me share with you where we want to start.
Ms. Hill, can I say something while you're
certainly
pulling that up? So the questions for the course point or Lippincott videos are now posted, and there is allowance for 6 uploads on the assignment tab. I did go back and take off, I think, 2 things from the list that was posted because they weren't on the current site for the 4th edition. So if you've already printed it out, just look and mark off what I changed. And so it's ready for y'all.
Okay. So we're going to start with chapter 10. Begins on page 323 in the textbook. And one of the new things that they've added is called Words of Wisdom. And I really liked this one. Being a nurse without all AWE is like food without spice. Nurses only have to witness a miracle of life to find their lost all. And that's so true. I think when you have this opportunity, you will find that to be the case. Now, this chapter, I am going to...
Is this supposed to be recorded?
Thank you. I can never remember that. So, yes, it is supposed to be recorded. Just a minute. Oh, thank you. Yes, we are now recording. Thank you so much. I can have it. I've got a note right here on my computer at the bottom that says record. So I'm just so excited to get to start talking about this, I guess is why I forget that. But I digress. So now chapter 10 is fetal development and genetics. Now we are really just kind of touching on this, okay? We're not going to really go into genetics. There have been comments before in the evaluations about how we would discuss the mother's changes during pregnancy, but we really never kind of discussed how that began and how the placenta functioned and those type things. So this chapter will cover that, and so that's what we are going to talk about today. So, time span. The ovum is released from the ovary, as we saw in the little video. It passes into an open fallopian tube and starts its journey downward towards the sperm for fertilization. Now, your textbook will has some good pictures. Again, like I said, it's not my intent to really write down this. I really want to just kind of highlight and topics and specifics that I think will help you better understand what's going on throughout the pregnancy. So we have this little ovum. The egg is now journeying through the fallopian tube down towards usually the upper horn of the uterus to begin its implantation, to meet up with its guy. So there's a good little table, 10.1, that shows the embryonic and the fetal development that I think you can get a lot from with it. It's just interesting to be able to peruse that and understand. So what we're talking here is functions of the placenta. That's one of the things that we never probably got into as much as y'all wanted to know. So now we are. So the function of the placenta, it serves as the interface between the mother and the fetus. It makes the hormones to control the physiology of the mother to ensure the fetus is getting the nutrients and oxygen that it needs. It also protects the fetus from an immune attack by the mother. It also removes the waste products from the fetus, because you will find as we're going through this and talking, you know, the baby is voiding and stooling. Well, no, I mean, we don't want it stooling while it's in utero, and that will sometimes happen, and you'll have further discussion on that when we get into labor and delivery. But they do, they're taking in the amniotic fluid, they're swallowing it, and then they pass it back through as urine. The placenta also induces the mother to bring more food to the placenta and produces hormones that mature the fetal organs. Development's highly regulated process, and it's essential for normal fetal development. Development by the end of the second week process begins, and structure complete by 12 weeks. This is in reference to the placenta. It acts as a pass-through between the mother and the fetus, not a barrier. So it is the baby's lifeline. They don't get three lifelines like they used to on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or whatever it was. This is it. We need it to stay intact and to function accordingly. So one of those little deals talking about take note, the new that they've added states that fetal circulation functions to carry highly oxygenated blood to vital areas while first shunting it away from less important ones, the lungs and liver. Now that's in utero, remember that. The placenta essentially takes over the functions of the lungs and the liver during fetal life. As a result, large volumes of oxygenated blood are needed. So with that being said too, then we'll move to the umbilical cord. Oh, sorry, too fast. This is formed from the amnion. It's the lifeline from the mother to the growing embryo. It contains one large vein and two small arteries. So a good way to remember that is AVA. Artery, vein, artery. The substance surrounding those vein and arteries is called Wharton jelly. It surrounds those to prevent them from being compressed. A term, the average umbilical cord is 22 inches in length and about one inch wide. So you want to be sure and at a delivery, after the delivery, ask if the placenta's not going to be sent to pathology, for exam. Ask if you can take it aside, not leave the building with it, but find a place where y'all can put it on a table, spread it out, and really check it out. Because I want you to take that cord and look at it and see if you can find that one large vein and the two small arteries. As we'll discuss later on in our lectures, there's it's important to know that those three vessels are there. So they should be inspected after delivery, and it should be reported to the newborn nurse the presence of those three vessels, because once the cord is clamped, it's hard oftentimes for the newborn nurse to be able to tell about those vessels. So you do need to check those out in the delivery setting. The cord reaches its maximum length, typically by 30 weeks. And this oftentimes is determined by genetics and intrauterine space and fetal activity. If a baby is very active, I have seen at delivery that the mothers reported how active this baby was during pregnancy, and the cord may be just extremely long because this baby has moved and turned and pulled and everything. The problem with a really long cord is it can then wrap around extremities, wrap around the neck or the trunk, and create some stress on the baby once labor ensues, and possibly even before such time. So the amniotic fluid. The amniotic fluid helps maintain a constant body temperature for the fetus. It permits symmetric growth and development, cushions the fetus from trauma. It allows the umbilical cord to be relatively free of compression, and it promotes fetal movement to enhance musculoskeletal development. So it's surrounding the embryo, and it begins to increase in volume as the pregnancy progresses. At term, it reaches approximately 1 liter. It's derived from two sources: fluid transported from the maternal blood across the amnion and fetal urine. It's composed of 98% water and 2% organic matter. And that's going to be vernix, epithelial cells, fine hair called lanugo. And the composition changes with the gestation. When we get into talking about the newborn, we'll kind of probably get more into that. If you have the opportunity, if you've ever seen your premature babies, they're born and they've got all that little fine downy hair all over them. That's called lanugo. And as the baby gets older, as it gets closer to term, it loses a lot of that. Oftentimes, term babies may have a little bit on their shoulders, and maybe just a little bit down around the coccyx area, but otherwise they're pretty much have shed all of that lanugo. Well, it's in the amniotic fluid. The same with the vernix. The younger the baby is at birth, they may be covered with a lot of the cheesy substance that you can't wipe off. It's protecting, it's a barrier for the skin. As they get older, they start losing that, so that term babies oftentimes we'll have just maybe in the creases or the folds of their legs, in the creases, folds of the elbows, those type things. The volume of amniotic fluid is important to determine fetal well-being. Too little is called oligohydraminous. That's usually indicative of less than 500 mils of amniotic fluid. And it's associated with uteroplacental insufficiency and renal insufficiency in the newborn, in the fetus. Too much is called hydraminose. This is greater than 2,000 cc's. You may also hear it called polyhydraminose. It's associated with maternal diabetes, with neural tube defects, and malformations of the GI tract. As a result of this uterine overdistension, it may also bring about premature rupture of membranes. You'll see that abbreviated as PROM, P-R-O-M, premature rupture of the membranes. So even though if you've ever been around somebody and their water broke and they've had, you know, an uncomplicated pregnancy, all's going well, they're measuring according to term, you know, the chances are there's no more than a liter of fluid. But when it's gushing, you know, and hitting the floor or whatever, it certainly seems to be a whole lot more than that. So talking about the fetal circulation, which when I read that take note a little too early for you. Fetal circulation functions to carry highly oxygenated blood to vital areas, such as the heart and the brain. It's blood from the placenta to and through the fetus and then back to the placenta. Figure 10.9, which is on page 333, shows you how that works. Now, we do not really go into this in depth because it will be covered in pediatrics. But what happens is there's three shunts during fetal life. You have the ductus venous. It connects the umbilical vein to the inferior vena cava and bypasses the liver. While the ductus arteriosus connects the main pulmonary artery to the aorta and it bypasses the lungs. And the foramen ovale is the anatomic opening between the right and left atrium and it bypasses the right ventricle. So you can see just with what you may have already had med-surg wise, this is nothing like what goes on when you're born. I mean, what has to happen when the baby is born and the cord is clamped is these shunts have to now reverse themselves. The foramen ovale has to close and, no, PDA has to close. That's what it is. But they have now got to flip themselves because they're no longer dependent on mother providing that blood. They've got to move it themselves. So again, like I said, the main thing to know is being aware of there's three shunting and what it's doing. And typically once the cord is clamped, two of those will shut immediately. Sometimes the ductus arteriosus may be the one that'll be delayed in closing. And while it's got to close eventually, you can still kind of hear some of it where it hadn't completely closed, even a few days after birth. And they'll just keep an eye on it. But typically it is going to close and it's not going to require surgical intervention. On your term babies, often you will hear of preterms do have to have a surgery to close it. They call it PDA, patent ductus arteriosus, in that it's staying open and they have to go in and do a surgical intervention for them. So, just briefly talking genetics and advances in genetic knowledge. Genetics is the study of hereditary and variations. So if we have a baby that is born with some sort of genetic defect, then they're going to want to do studies. And then that then becomes kind of backing on up and doing studies of mom and dad and just trying to determine, you know, is there a side of the family this came from? Is this a genetic type thing or is it just a result of the environment or something like that? Pharmacogenomics is the study of the genetic and genomic influences on pharmacodynamics and pharmacotherapies. Part of perinatal care for decades has been genetic testing and therapy. One of the things I discovered when I was working in the NI, I was the manager of the NI at Shepherd for quite some time. You know, we would get a tremendous number of babies from East Texas. This was before they had their own NIs in Longview areas. So we got a lot of babies from Longview that would have respiratory problems, maybe they would have some defects that weren't necessarily attributed to genetics. And we always felt like it maybe was a result of the chemical plants that, you know, they had going on around Longview, the big Kodak plant and things like that. We used to get a lot of babies that would come in and, you know, oftentimes in if to rule out, was it a genetic problem? There was a geneticist at LSU Health that would come and consult, and there still are, I think, that would consult and, you know, do the testing of the baby, talk to the mother and the parents and, you know, could really just in conversation identify and put together a lot of information as to what was going on with that baby just through talking because of his vast knowledge. So the nursing role and responsibilities in regards to both the fetus and the genetics is one of the things, and we'll digress in women's health and talk some about this, is the preconception counseling process and referring for further genetic information. If in the history taken, when a couple, say, goes in and talks to the their OB, they find out that there's a history of some sort of genetic problem in one side of, you know, be it the mother or the father, they may recommend genetic testing before conceiving so they can identify if there's going, if they carry that particular gene and have some idea of what their chances are of carrying it into a pregnancy. So it certainly has its role. It, you know, it explains the purpose, the risk and benefits of moving forward with a pregnancy. So as the nurse, certainly we want to be able to get them directed into the right direction of who they need to talk to, if they have these questions, if you know, and if they don't feel like they've been answered satisfactorily, that to hear what they have to say and to be able then to guide them into, you know, the direction they need to maybe further obtain the information they need. Of course, you know, if any of you have encountered or had to go through preconception and genetic testing, you know, oftentimes your health insurance may not cover it. You may not want to use your health insurance. Oftentimes, if they know there's a, you know, a known genetic thing, they don't want to be tagged with that, so that, you know, they change insurances or something and it's tagged out there, this person, you know, has a genetic marker for such and such, that, you know, you could potentially have trouble getting insurance. So some people want to pay out of pocket and have not have that, you know, enter into their health insurance. It's all very personal, and a lot of decisions that require a lot of thinking and discussion between the couple and then, you know, with their health care provider. As with any of them, there's always typically going to then come into some ethical, legal, and social issues. You identify that your baby has, say, genetic markers or has a particular defect that is not found to be comparable with sustained life for any length of time, if in fact they're even born alive, you know, and so they recommend the termination of the pregnancy once they identify this. You know, then it's a matter of that becomes a parental decision and, you know, the choices they have to make. So, a lot goes into this, and it becomes a specialized area with people that have that specialized information. So our role, say we're in an OB office, is to just provide emotional support and be there for them. So with that in mind, that's pretty much what I wanted to cover in chapter 10. Just to give you an idea of what's going on, how these things come about. So I didn't really at that point select any of the NCLEX questions at the end of the chapter. So because I'll have that as we get into a little more information here. So hold on a second. So get rid of that, and now we want to move to chapter 11. Chapter chapter 12 is probably going to be our most in-depth. Well, the last two chapters, 12 and 19, have a lot of content to cover. But we have a lot to cover here in chapter 11 also. So, chapter 11 begins on page 350.